Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around, by RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Island Marathon 40th anniversary coming up on Saturday, March 11th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $80 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville and on iTunes. Our next guest, one of America's premier runners, Mr. Will Lear, joins us. Will, how are you?
I am doing awesome, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thanks so much for taking time. So, growing up, you were more of a soccer player than anything else?
Absolutely. You know, I would say that I was following in my brother's footsteps, and he was always a trendsetter in my eyes, and he fell in love with soccer at an early age, and I sort of followed suit. And from the soccer fields and vast plains of Minnesota, you know, my legs and lungs were born.
So you and your brother were the guys who were tracking down Premier League games on the weekends to watch all the big boys play.
Well, you know, I'm 31 years old. My brother's 33. It wasn't that easy when we were growing up. You know, you couldn't just turn on NBC Sports like you can now and get, you know, all of those beautifully high-definition live feeds. We generally had to resort to videotapes. But they made their way. We passed them around. They were highly coveted items of, you know, oh, this was the semifinal match of France and Brazil in the 1998 World Cup, or you know, things like that.
That's cool. Well, that's sort of like
good fun.
Us growing up trying to find Tour de France and things like that. It was like you had to find old VHSs and find all the classic stuff. So you didn't really get into running until later in high school?
Yeah. I transitioned from tennis as my spring sport of choice, oddly enough, to track and field my sophomore year. And, you know, for life choices beyond just having an innate ability to run around and turn left, it was a good choice, as I was an incredible hothead on the tennis court. And my mom actually told me that she refused to come and watch me play tennis anymore because I would be the guy out there smashing rackets and, you know, saying expletives and such. And so I was able to turn all of that energy towards singular focus on the track. And thanks to an amazing group of seniors, when I was just a sophomore, they sort of took me under their wing and showed me the ropes. And then they, as good mentors do, they let me fly free.
So you were basically the John McEnroe of Minnetonka High School.
Yeah, I'm not sure that the coach even remembers it that way, but my mom definitely would remember it that way. It was, these were experiences that, you know, now as I get older and I have friends with kids and, you know, I'm getting closer and closer with them, that just real cringeworthy stuff that you, if you saw someone else's child acting that way, you'd be like, man, I feel badly for their parent. Yeah, that was me. But luckily, she only had to endure that for one season. Of which she only probably endured 25% of it until she stopped coming to watch. So
I love that.
You know, hats off to her for being a driving force in my track and field career.
So starting so late in high school, when you started thinking about college, were there any colleges recruiting you? You ended up at Pomona. Were other colleges looking at you for running?
Not as many as one would think. So I finished third in the Minnesota State High School Championship in the 800 my junior year. But I'd only run 156. And the way, you know, that all this stuff works in Division I college recruiting is that if you're junior, they go on your junior year, because by the time you get to senior year track season, decisions are made.
Exactly,
you know,
like
teams, yeah. Rosters are set. You got no chance. And I wasn't a cross-country runner, really. And so, because the fault was soccer season for us, And it wasn't really until April or May of my senior year that I sort of like started putting down some times that caught people's attention. But when I did, the letters and the phone calls, they came pretty quickly. And the strong contenders for me, I was very academically minded in high school. I absolutely wanted to run in college, but first and foremost was education.
Yeah.
And Coach Charlie Powell at University of Pennsylvania actually was one of my first official visit was out to UPenn. I took a visit at Penn before I took a visit at the University of Minnesota, strangely enough. And, I loved Penn, but it didn't quite have the right mix for me. It was a little bit too urban. And when I came out to Pomona, I think it was in March of my senior year. So people know what March is like in the Midwest. It can be 80 degrees and it can be 80 below. And I think my senior year it was the latter.
Yes.
And so I went out and it was, 70 degrees and sunny. And I was like, yeah, this is what it is every single day.
Well,
and that pretty much sold me.
Yeah. And then Pomona, it seemed like obviously you had an awesome career at Pomona, right? Four Division III titles, the only male Division III runner to win the 1500 and 5000 in the same meet. What was it that did you feel was just a maturation process from high school to college, or was it the coaching? What turned it around for you?
My college career, I'd say, other than like a hiccup my sophomore year where I suffered with anemia,
mm-hmm.
It was sort of just like a linear progression. If you would have drawn a line from my high school times through my freshman year of college, and obviously those are like converted 15 to 1600 meter times, and then just sort of like continue that line through my sophomore year, the curve would look fairly linear. I mean, there weren't really any huge exponential jumps. I don't know. I started taking it really seriously, training, that is.
Yeah.
And putting, logging hard miles in the summer the year before my junior year, because we had a group of guys at Pomona that, and I'm still extremely close with them. I'm actually in Los Angeles right now. My dear friend and teammate and the person who I actually attribute the majority of my running success to, Crosby Freeman, he is getting inducted to the College Hall of Fame this weekend. So we're all of us come back for that. We're still very close. We're all best friends.
Sweet.
And we decided that we had an opportunity to do something that had never been done at Pomona before, that we've had a core group of very talented athletes. And, through a Google chat, I think it was a Google chat group at the time, kept everyone very accountable over the summer. And we saw the gains of that in the fall. And then, success begets success. And a successful cross-country season turned into my first national title indoors, which sort of opened my eyes to saying, wow, that was pretty fun. That was cool. Let's try and do that outdoors. And then outdoors, Nick Simmons and I had an absolutely epic battle in the 1500 that I'll never forget. And at this time, Nick and I already were good friends in Division III level. And then when I saw Nick really do what he did that year, so that was the summer of 2006, he ran 340. And then ran 145 and took second place at the U.S. Outdoor Championships. I said, maybe there's something to this. Maybe I got something here. And then, so the rest is history. That really fueled my drive going into my senior year. And then, obviously made the decision to continue training as a professional.
So we always, when you look at running, you're running as an amateur. And then really after college, you're sort of in this, while you're in college, you got this cocoon of support. People are, you're flying places with your school. Then when you're out of college, you're sort of, okay, nice knowing you. You can you try to make it on the roads. You can try to get to the Olympics. Did you have a sort of a clear path once you were heading towards graduation that I want to make it as a runner and I want to go to the Olympics and I think I have the support for this?
Absolutely not.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But I think, to be perfectly frank with you, I think that being a Division III athlete prepared me for the life of professional athletics for someone who doesn't, you know, I wasn't Matt Centrowitz in college, you know.
Right.
I wasn't Robert Chesrek. These guys that are going to come out and they're going to be taken care of.
Yep.
And have everything looked after. They're never going to have to ask a question on how much something costs, whether or not their travel is going to be covered to a meet. And we didn't have that at Pomona. Pomona took good care of us, but still, I distinctly remember that our per diem when we would go on a trip was like $17 a day. So you either had to make that $17 stretch to three meals, or you know, you planned accordingly and went to the grocery store and you grouped together with people and sort of made your small pie bigger that way. And we were held accountable. Nothing was done really for us. We had a lot of say. We didn't travel. We were in Southern California. What do you need to travel for?
That's true.
We had the best meets in the country. We're all within a 90-minute drive. When we did travel, it was only to national meets. And then our coach would say, you know, when do you guys want to leave?
Right.
When do you want to come back? Like, there were only a select few of us, so we didn't have to deal with this huge team. But that accountability, being forced to make those decisions and not have them always made for me, made the transition to a professional lifestyle easy because it was just more of the same. I had no idea what professional track and field was. So don't let me dissuade you and say that, oh, I knew that I was going to sign this contract and be with a professional coach and with professional track. I had no idea.
Right.
What I knew of professional track and field was that once a year at the Pomona Pitzer Invitational, which I was super fortunate, got to watch guys like Jason Lund and Michael Stember come down and battle it out on our track. But they ran for the Nike Farm Team.
Yeah.
And the farm team, I thought that's what professional track was. That was it. That's all I knew. That was my experience. And when the farm team turned into the Oregon Track Club, and again, I'm bringing up Nick Simmons. Nick Simmons went to the OTC. I called Nick. I said, Nick, what's the deal with the OTC? He's like, it's awesome. Gags are the best coach ever. Have your coach call him. So my coach called Gags and said, hey, Gags, I got a guy. What does he need to do to qualify for your team? And Gags sort of like laid out these parameters. And when I hit him, he said, cool, come to Eugene. Let's start something.
So it sounds like things were moving fairly quickly. All of a sudden, you're done with college. You're up in Eugene. And how was that experience? Because now you're running with one of the things I think that has really helped American distance running back in the day, and when we had Athletics West, this is way before you were born, in the 80s, when we had Athletics West and you had Alberto and all these guys training together, they got good. And when that stuff went away, and obviously the East Africans got really, really good, the American distance running suffered. And when the Mammoth Track Club started with Meb and Dina and Ryan back in the 2000s, leading into 2004, all of a sudden Americans were doing well again. And the Oregon Project and what's going on in Arizona and the Brooks Group, the Hansons, those teams really helped make people better. Did you find that you really improved by running with these guys?
I can tell you that I showed up to Eugene about 2.5 weeks before official team practice.
Yeah.
I needed to get settled. I had an apartment to move in. I had nothing in college. I had no furniture. I just had a car full of, some dusty trophies and some stinky running shorts at the time. And it took me a couple of weeks to get settled, and Gags was off doing whatever Gags was doing in the summer with athletes that were racing. And so me and a couple of the other guys that were there basically, we're left to our own devices of like going and finding a gym to do some stuff in. But the first official day of practice, I remember very, very distinctly, there's this little section of track over by the Hammer Pits at Hayward Field.
Yeah.
Sort of behind the 1500 meter start, there's like a little shed and there's a little section of track. And we met on the track, and I looked around and I said, holy crap. Every guy here has run under 146 or under 4 minutes.
Yeah.
Or around 13:20 for 5K. And I just sort of looked around and I was like, this is awesome. Because, you know, these guys, I was a Division III guy. I looked up to these. I mean, these were all my idols.
Right.
And getting to watch them compete in Southern California, it was like, someday I want to get there. Someday. And then I sort of had this light bulb. And I was like, the day is here. And then slowly but surely, you know, chipping away at the block, you find yourself in one of those situations, which I imagine high schoolers' first experience in their freshman year in the Division I program, where it's like, oh, God, I'm in over my head. And then very quickly you realize, no, I'm not. Like, I am also here. I am in this group, and it's not, you know, for any other reason other than that I'm qualified. And the, you know, you gain confidence through training with the best. And I firmly believe that. And I've been fortunate in my career to have training partners to look up to, training partners who look up to me. And, you know, that mutually beneficial relationship, I think, is where success is bred. It was pretty cool. I mean, I'm not going to lie. That's a memory that I'll cherish from my career for the rest of my life.
Huh. And how long was it before you felt, you know what, I do belong?
It took a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
But that was also a learning curve from a coaching perspective. Gags took a little bit of time to, because you're in the fall, you know, people come in at so varying levels of fitness. Some people are just coming off of a long racing, summer racing season over in Europe or on the roads, and other people have been doing base training since, you know, the end of July or something like that. And so, I sort of got slotted in really quickly, and Gags at the time was very much into grouping athletes together. And so I remember some of our early workouts, we'd have like 10 or 12 guys out running, you know, K reps and mile repeats and tempo runs around the Amazon Trail in Eugene. And it seemed crazy because I was so not used to that from my college experience. I was so used to just doing things kind of by myself by the time I was a senior. And, it was definitely one of those things where, like, I don't remember the workout, but I remember, you know, the workout started with about 12 people. And towards the end, I looked around and it was me and maybe one other guy. And I was like, oh, all right.
I do belong.
I do belong. Yeah.
I love
that. I can
that.
Do this.
Now, so was that leading into the 2008 season?
Yes. Yeah, that was fall 2007 leading into 2008.
So in 2008, you go to the trials at 1,500 meters, correct?
Yep.
And you get to the finals, your first Olympic trials.
Got to the finals and my first Olympic trials. Yeah, that was a pretty crazy experience. I mean, it was the first trials in Eugene since, was it, 72?
Yeah, a long time. You're right, yeah.
And, you know, Vin had done an incredible job, and everyone that was working at the time with the local organizing committee did an incredible job. But I got to watch Eugene transform from being, sleepy track town to the epicenter of track and field in America. And there was this clock. We called it the Eye of Sauron, to make a Lord of the Rings reference, that when you drove over the Ferry Street Bridge in Eugene,
yeah,
or the Coburg Bridge,
Over
the Coburg Bridge, over near where the Fifth Street Market is now, there was this clock in red block numbers. It was a countdown clock. Days to the trials.
Wow.
And you get there in August, late August, and it's like, 260, and you're like, that is forever. And I have so much time, and it's like it goes from 260 to 200 to 150, and you're like, we got so much time. And then you blink your eyes, and it's like, two.
That is so,
like,
funny.
Shit,
yeah.
I got workouts to do. I got, like, what's going on? And so, yeah, that was, you know, there was a huge benefit and also detriment to being in Eugene. It was a constant reminder of what was ahead. But I think that was a great trials. A lot of the guys that are here in Los Angeles with me this weekend to celebrate our teammate made the trip up to Eugene that week, and I had probably 15 college teammates in the stands going absolutely nuts. And that performance was as much for me as it was validation of what we worked so hard to achieve. Everyone has their goals. That's the beauty of sport, is that like you can have your own goals, and they don't have to be, not everyone is going to go to the Olympics, but you can want to cut 5 seconds off of your 5K, whatever that time may be. And so this was a validation for a lot of the work that we put in together.
Were you surprised to make it to the finals?
No.
You expected to make the finals?
Absolutely. And that was sort of ingrained from the culture that really took form from December onwards.
Yeah.
And stuff that, Gags would take me aside a lot. Bring me over to the house and have a cup of tea with he and his wife, and he'd say, this is all fine. Training's going really well. But what's important is that semifinal at the Olympic trials. You got to make the final. You make the final, anything can happen. And so he had me very mentally prepared.
And how did that finals play out?
Unfortunately, I'd say. I knew about 600 meters in that I wasn't going to be an Olympian.
Oh, why? Just did they go out? Was the pace too fast?
No, it was too slow. I didn't have the qualifying standard, and there were only about six athletes that did.
I got it.
All six of whom I'm pretty sure were in the final.
Right.
And so it was a little bit of cat and dog. But, Gag pulled me aside before the race and said, don't worry about the time. Just run your ass off.
Right.
Just compete. And that's the Gagliano, all of his athletes will tell you, just get in there and compete.
Right.
So that's pretty much what I did. I just kind of sort of sat around and did my time. There was a lot of, I just remember an aggressive amount of pushing and shoving. And then when sort of the lanes opened up over the last lap, was start gunning people down. And, to be that close, I think it was the best possible outcome. I think I would have been really discouraged if I would have finished top three and not made the team.
Because you didn't have the standard.
Because I didn't have a standard, yeah.
Yeah.
To be fourth, to have a sniff,
yeah.
To know that it was there, and that I just had a couple of other, boxes to tick in the world track and field before that next one, that really propelled the next 4 years of my career, for sure.
So the next, basically, after that, now it's okay. London, and it's on. And this is what I want to do. Now, when I look at your variety from 147 for 800 to 334 for 1500, 351 for the mile, and 819 for the for 2 mile, 1321 for 5000. Were you automatically thinking 1500 for 2012?
I love the mile.
Yeah,
I really do. It's a beautiful event. It's exciting. And I sort of thought in 2008, I learned more what I didn't know about the event than what I did know.
Mm.
And I learned the areas that I had absolutely to improve. I learned areas that I was exceptionally lucky to have skills in. So you try and chisel away at that ice block and to create a beautiful sculpture. And I was pretty committed to running the 1500 for the next 4 years. It is an enormous jump up to the 5K. And at the time, I had no interest.
Oh, right. That's a long way to go. That's a lot of laps.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you remember about the 351? I mean, there's not that many people around who've run 351 for the mile.
I remember being surrounded by great friends in the running world. The guys who put on the Morton Games in Dublin have worked tirelessly to resurrect an event that, for all intents and purposes, was dead. But they put a lot of energy into the mile because it's, as I was sort of saying earlier, it's this beautiful event that people like to watch in track and field. People, unfortunately, if it's not properly commented or you don't have a local superstar in the 5K, no one cares.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The mile has the mile is sexy, right? There's something very special about it.
It's long enough for it to be more than just an all-out sprint, and also for tactics to play such an enormous role. Also, in Ireland, Ireland has a great history of terrific milers.
Eamon Coghlan, and the chairman of the board. Come on.
Yeah, Eamon Coghlan, Ray Flynn. You know, these guys that were around the same time in, like, that late 70s, just absolutely smashing.
Yeah.
And running, 351, 351, 352, just like day in and day out. These guys were just machines. And, you know, all of them, to their regard, were sub-350-minute milers. And so there was this history of an event that it was like, I don't know really how to put it. It's sort of like a garage find in like car terminology. Like, you find this thing, and you're like, there's so much potential here. It was once this great event, and these guys have done an exceptional job at trying to resurrect it. And I'd won there two times in the past, and no one had, the only other person that had won three times was Steve Scott. And they put a lot of great athletes on the line. And, like, honestly, it was a race where I'll go back and watch it, and I don't remember most of it. I remember a decisive move that was made by an athlete, an Irish athlete, who was trying to get a, I think it was his European standard, European championship standard.
Mm-hmm.
So the European champs or world champs at the time?
Yeah.
No, it was 2014, so it was European championships, which is a huge deal in Europe.
It is.
And so they had a 1,500-meter standard out on the track with, you know, fully automatic timing and all that. And so he took off, and it was instinctual. It was like, well, there it is. That's the race. You got to go. And it wasn't thinking, oh, this guy's going for the 1,500. You have a whole 109 meters left to go. But at that point, none of that mattered. I was just in the race and did everything that I could to win, knowing full on that, Pat Casey that summer was on fire. And I knew he was going to be hard charging behind me. He had a terrific finish. And I knew Zane Robertson was in great shape, the Kiwi middle distance athlete. And Kyle Merber was in good shape. And all these guys, they were just, chomping at the bit. And so I had no idea. All I knew was that I came off of the turn, was running down the home stretch. My legs were starting to get heavy. And the announcer, I could just hear him say, this is something special. And I was like, oh, I don't know what's going on, but I better keep going. And then coming across the line and seeing 351, it blew me away.
Wow. When you look back, was that your best ever race?
It was definitely one of my best races. I think one of my, who knows what, if there is a best ever. I guess if you won an Olympic gold medal, that might be
right.
The best race I've ever run.
Yeah.
But I remember winning the Wanamaker Mile that same season, 2014, in a race that I had no expectation of winning because I trained with Nick Willis and I knew every workout that he had done. And I knew that he was obnoxiously fit and just happened to, as luck has it, be stricken with a little bit of a cold the week of the race and was not quite feeling up to himself. But that was a race where it's like everything went right. You sometimes have races that you just grind from the beginning, and I'm sure the people listen to your show and know exactly what I'm talking about, that from...
Yep.
In a triathlon, you get in the water, and it's like your body just wants to sink. But you grind it out, and then you get on the bike, and you grind it out, and you sort of throw all of your expectations away. And then all of a sudden, at the end of the race, you're like, I'm motoring. I'm absolutely crushing. I have no idea. This has felt terrible from the start of the race, but somehow my body is producing an incredible result. And that was not the case with the Wanamaker battle. Everything sort of felt too easy. And with a lap to go on the indoor track, I was like, you know, had an experience of saying, I have so much running left in my legs, I better just really get out and let them go. And yeah, that was a pretty cool event to win. Again, just another absolutely historic mile event. My dad was there in the stands. I had a bunch of friends that live in New York were there. And so it's always been really important to me to perform with friends and family around.
What's great about track and field and, you know, all the other sports we're involved with, it's pretty pure when you're out there just racing and you're training and doing the things you love to do. You went through a period where, you know, when you're dealing with sponsorship stuff and, you know, you're with a company you don't want to be with. Sometimes when that type of thing happens, it affects you more than you think it does. Your training, your racing, everything is compromised a little bit because the purity is gone. How hard was that for you while you were going through the issues with Nike and your contract and all the rest of that to just focus on what you love about being a professional runner?
Yeah. So it's no secret that my 2015 and 2016 seasons were not up to par, as I would say, for what my expectations are of myself as an athlete.
Sure.
2015, I had my first real serious injury as a professional athlete.
What'd you do?
And I tore both of my groin muscles where they attach to your pubic bone.
How'd you do that? Just running?
It's an overuse injury. Yeah,
oh, my God.
You know, it wasn't like, I just tore my groin muscles. It was like my groin's sore. And, you know, we're very stubborn people, athletes, and especially distance athletes, and we just disregard it, pop a couple ibuprofen, move on with the day. So I had a pretty major surgery in the fall of 2015 and was really working did everything that I could to get myself to the starting line of the Olympic trials. I had to post a qualifying time and try and convince myself that I was fit enough to do it. And then with all the added stress from that of this contract dispute, I firmly believe that the body cannot differentiate between one or another type of stress.
I agree.
And whether you're getting stress from running, you know, 120 miles a week, or you have stress from running 40 miles a week, but you're working 80 hours a week at a job, you're breaking down your body all the same and impairing its ability to recover. And last year I wore it down way too much, and I actually struggled with diagnosed by medical professionals as overtraining syndrome, even though I wasn't able to train as much as I was in years past. But all this extra extra stress was just really wearing me down from on a day in and a day out basis, and it was hard because you lose that drive to wake up every morning, and it's hard enough to the morning after an excruciatingly difficult workout, get up and be like, yeah, what I want to do today is I want to go train again.
exactly.
Yeah, like I want to lay in bed all day. And so to, you know, have a enormous entity sort of bogging you down and sort of a colossal David and Goliath fight on your hands, that it did take a lot of the joy out of it. But again, I wouldn't be where I am today. I mean, I haven't accomplished everything there is to accomplish in the world. I'm not resting on my laurels by any sense. But I wouldn't have been able to do the things that I've done in the running world without the support of family and friends. And through it all, you know, my coaches, my training partners, my wife, my parents, my brother, teammates from years and years and years, and not more than that, but in addition to that, having folks in the running world that just would come up, even not in the running world, in the sporting world, come and say, man, you know, that really sucks what happened last year, but admirable for, we admire you for standing up and not backing down. And that has made getting up every single morning this year, putting my shoes on. Now with a company that believes in me, that I believe in, that I'm happy to be with, it makes it easier. And the joy, the pep is back in my step. Training is going exceptionally well, but it's different. Its difference is important because sometimes as endurance athletes are, we have to compare what I'm doing now to what I did before. Well, sure. What did I do that made me successful in 2014? Well, I go back and I look at my 2014 log because I'm a narcissist. And I see things and I'm like, oh my gosh, I haven't done any of that yet. And I call my coach, Ron Warhurst, and he says, of course you haven't done that. We're not doing that yet. And so it's like, okay, great. What's the workout today, Ronnie? Let's go. Let's crush it. And I know that he is a mastermind. He is, while sinister and evil, he has my best interests in mind. And so I have unwavering faith in him to direct. I mean, I watched him direct Nick Willis as the oldest ever Olympic medalist in the 1500 last year.
Right.
And he obviously knows what he's doing.
So what are the goals for this year? This point we're in 2017, Tokyo's coming up in 2020. I'm imagining that's the ultimate goal.
My goals are more simple. This year is return to world-class levels of performance. Mm-hmm. If that puts me on the starting line in London for the World Championships, fantastic. And that's obviously where we all want to be, and I crave more than anything as a competitor. But re-enjoying the process of competing, because last year at the Olympic Trials, I didn't enjoy it because I knew that my body was cooked. I knew that I didn't really have a chance, but I also knew that I wouldn't respect myself the following morning if I didn't get out there and put myself on the starting line.
Right.
And so it's going to take a lot mentally. I have some hurdles to overcome of getting my confidence back. But every day, every workout, it's like, it's coming back. It's coming back. It's coming back. And so I'm really excited for some of the early season races. And I'm sort of just focusing on that right now. I'm not going like big picture. I'm saying, what's the goal this week? What are we working on this week? What am I working on today? Because if I look too big, that's a huge amount of stress. Gotcha. I'm just taking it one day at a time. With obviously, you know, if you were to look down that very long tunnel that is my athletics career, you know, there are some things at the end that I can barely make out. But and those are some of the lofty reminders. But to alleviate the stress and really enjoy the process right now, I think is very important.
So, like you said, you come from a Division III school. You know when there's back then there weren't a lot of expectations for you. When you look at what you've gone through, the whole thing with switching sponsors and feeling like, hey, I don't want to be with this company. I feel like I'm an indentured servant and I have to be there, and then being able to extricate yourself from that situation. Going through that, does it make you appreciate what you can do now more than before?
Absolutely. And it was never really, I guess, when I was with Nike about things that I couldn't do. It was just a lot of personalities that existed there and how they thought that the sport of track and field should be run. And that's basically exactly how they wanted it at every single second of every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that just to be incredibly short-sighted, and it did not match with who I am as a person. I believe in kindness over anything.
Yep.
and generosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that was these were not the things that they lived by, but they were an enormous corporation, and they had people that they were accountable to. And so, like, I don't necessarily fault them for that. It just didn't work for you anymore.
Yeah,
it didn't work for you.
You needed to be somewhere that maybe is a little smaller, somewhere where you felt appreciative and you could appreciate you had a mutual relationship.
Yeah, and I think what is as important as a shift in my, let's call it my corporate allegiance.
Yeah.
This year is my wife and I just moved to Boulder, Colorado.
Nice.
And so we sort of upended our lives and had a radical change in our lifestyle, which is also an incredibly powerful thing. I mean, to be newly married and go on this adventure and changing everything about what we were doing, we found ourselves in an incredibly warm and accepting community in Boulder. And Aisha is training with Emma Coburn, who undoubtedly is one of the greatest athletes in the world.
No question.
We're learning a lot from her. And, you know, I'm learning something from a woman who's 5 years my junior, which is great. I mean, her and her fiance, Joe Bossa, they bring such a different perspective to track and field than what we were used to. Being in Eugene and even when I'm with Nick and Ronnie. And I think that's just one of the things about sport that's so interesting, and one of the things that I love so much is that everyone, there are 1,000 different ways to accomplish a goal, and they found a very successful way to do it and also maintain a healthy lifestyle. That's not always 110% every day about sport. It's about balance. And that was one of the things that we were missing so much when we were in Eugene. We were just missing balance. And I'm as excited as I am for my own selfish reasons, for my own career, I'm probably more excited for Aisha, because I get to watch her every day turning into the athlete that I've always thought that she could be. And it's, you know, again, it's just another thing that fuels my training every day. I see her becoming a better athlete daily, and it makes me want to be a better athlete. And so that's very exciting and fun for us.
How have you had to adapt? Like, coming back from the groin injuries, how have you had to adapt your training? Do you do more core work? Have you moved into some more cross training? Even you're a young guy.
I hate cross training.
Do you really? You're a runner, and
yeah,
I run.
I'm a runner.
Yeah.
And actually, I had the great fortune last year when I was initially coming back from my injury in Eugene to work with a therapist who had the same injury as me. And had the same surgery and dealt with recovery and sort of unfortunately told me in very pure, clear ways that exactly what I was to expect.
Yeah.
And I didn't believe him, but he was right. And he said, you know, cross training is one of those things that it can be good for you, but it can also, do you want to have a more quick return to running, or do you want to have a longer time when you're recovering from this injury, but you come back a little bit more fit?
Yeah.
Like, you can be running in 8 weeks and be a little bit fit, or you can be running 4 weeks and out of shape, but you're running. And so I sort of, cross training has its time. That's a whole other conversation. I'll skirt around that and say that what I've definitely had to do is listen to my body more.
Right.
Because that was one of the things that gets you into an overuse injury, is that you just stop listening. You think that a discomfort or a pain that you're experiencing is normal. Every day you get out of bed and your Achilles hurt. Okay, well, why is that? This isn't normal. Not everyone in the world doesn't wake up to sore Achilles. There's something that's going on, whether it's like, you know, you aren't hydrated enough at night, you're not stretching enough, the muscles around your lower leg aren't strong enough, and so your Achilles is overworking. So I have to pay attention, and I have to be a student more of the physiology of the human body, and my human body in particular as it relates to my running. Unfortunately, this year, I have given in to doing some warm-up drills. I used to be a guy, I'd wake up in the morning, have my breakfast and a cup of coffee, put my shoes on, lace them up, out the door, bam.
Right.
my warm-up was miles one and two.
Exactly.
Now I wake up in the morning, and I still go through the similar morning ritual, but I'm adding in mobility exercises and some light stretching and activation drills so that my body, when I go out the door, is, you know, your engine is warmed up, but not everyone in the world takes the time to go turn on their car 5 minutes before they leave the garage. But now I have to. It's a must, and if I don't, I absolutely feel it the next day.
You know what's so funny? I don't know if you've watched Meb Keflezighi's routine, but I've watched him out where I ride my bike on a regular basis. He does a full hour of warm-up drills before he takes a running step, every single run. And I'm like, wow. But that's how you create longevity.
We all have a thing to learn from Meb. And, you know, again, not everyone has the time that Meb has as a professional athlete.
Yep.
But, you know, we can take – and my physical therapist, John Ball, I'm sure he would prefer I do more than I do. But I'm not perfect. I'll admit to everyone that I'm the farthest thing from perfect. But I try, to incorporate things into my routine – and sometimes they last for a day, sometimes they last for a week, and sometimes they last for a year. So, yeah.
Hey, so you'll be in Boston. Are you going to run the mile there?
To be determined.
Oh, okay. You're not sure yet.
They have the mile and the 5K that day.
Right.
It is up to the next couple of weeks of training and how
sure.
my body, you know, I'm adapting to a new stress of living full-time and training full-time at altitude.
Yes.
And so Ronnie's got a couple of crazy ideas up his sleeve for workouts for me to do that will give me an idea of, you know, if I'm in mile shape or 5K shape. And the early season races will sort of be the distance of those races will be determined then.
Love it. Hey, Will.
But I'll definitely be out there, and I'm super excited to be around for Marathon Weekend.
Love it. And it'll be great to have you on our YouTube show when we're in Boston. That'd be great.
Oh, God, I can't wait.
Will, thank you so much for taking so much time. Appreciate getting to know you over the phone. You know, I love your personality, and I love what coming from a small college and then achieving what you've achieved. I know that fourth place in 2008 was only the beginning of the conversation in terms of your Olympic journey. There's a lot more to come. You can sort of sense that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Will Lear has been our guest again. We're brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, VeloFix.com, the coolest mobile bike shop around, RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Island Marathon 40th anniversary coming up on Saturday, March 11th, Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $80 million to give challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on Babbittville and on iTunes. And as always, endurance lives here.